Waiting for Robeson. Friday, January the 17th, 1958. In the paper, it said Glen Byam Shaw has invited the Negro singer Paul Robeson to come to Stratford this season. He's going to play Gower in Pericles. I've heard of him, but I don't think I've ever heard him sing. Mum has, and she says he's the best bass she's ever heard. June 20th. I've been meaning to put this down for ages and kept forgetting. Paul Robeson isn't coming to play Gower. He's a communist, and the American government won't let him out. The beasts. They're supposed to like Shakespeare. Whatever people say about the Russians, I bet they wouldn't have done that. We're still having a coloured singer for Gower, Edric Connor. Mum says she's not interested in anyone but Paul Robeson. Saturday, July the 12th. The pictures of Pericles were up outside Holt's, and it looks quite good, although the critics have been quite divided in their opinions about it. Paul Robeson has been let out of America, and he arrived in London last night. They might have let him out earlier so he could come and play Gower. Beasts. Thursday, October the 16th. Pericles tonight. Then I shall have seen the lot. It'll be the 21st I've seen. We haven't had a family party to the theatre since the birthday. A rather low evening, but most enjoyable. We were in Row J. I think this is the first time Pericles has been done properly here. In 1900 there was a polite version of it, and in 1947 the first act was excluded. But this time they've gone the whole hog with no refinements whatever. I don't know how much Barbara understood, but she hasn't asked any awkward questions yet. The first half was rather peculiar and most extraordinary. I'd never seen anything like it before, and at first I wasn't sure if I liked it, but I think I did now. Daddy thought it was delightful. Edric Connor as Gower has a very powerful voice and sang a great deal of his verses. I couldn't hear all the words, but I quite liked it. The theatre seemed a totally different place, and I forgot I was in the same place in which I saw Romeo and Juliet. Richard Johnson as Pericles was magnificent. Next to Mark Antony, I think it's his best part I've seen. The King of Antioch and his daughter looked rather eerie in sea green, and I think they're a couple of disgusting beasts. It makes me shudder. Barbara wasn't enjoying it very much. We went to the balcony bar, and I helped Mum drink some fizzy orange squash. Those brothel scenes were really... They were vulgar and horrid. We agreed they weren't very funny, but we couldn't help laughing, though, as Dad said, they left a rather nasty taste. The red curtain came down as the house lights went on, and we rose for the national anthem, which sounded rather odd after what we'd just seen. We walked home with Mr. Batsford. He's going on tour again, to Moscow and then to Stalingrad. Romeo, Twelfth Night and Hamlet are going. Daddy told Granny the story of Pericles after Barbara had gone to bed. She was rather shocked. I think it was excellent and well worth seeing again. Jennifer called for me after lunch. It was quite cold and felt funny going to the theatre in the afternoon. There seemed a slightly different atmosphere in the auditorium, but the play didn't seem any different. We sat in Row J. Jennifer made some rather scathing remarks about the appearance of the stage. There was some peculiar writing on the curtain, and looking at it through the glasses, I realised it was Pericles, Prince of Tyre, in exotic letters. Daddy thinks it's a very clever production, and I agree with him. It is, and makes the play seem worth more than it does when you read it. It never struck me how humorous Simonides is until I saw it. When he was reading his daughter's letter and said, "Good, her choice agrees with mine," and all his little asides when he was trying the two out, it had me in fits. Compared with plays like Romeo and Juliet, it doesn't at all sound like Shakespeare, except for bits. One during the storm when Pericles cried, "Thou God of this great vast, rebuke these surges." I think the play was divided, so that the part which is supposed to be mainly non-Shakespeare was before the interval, and the rest afterwards, which was quite a good arrangement. The first half finished with Gower and the sailors sitting peeling potatoes with an orange light on them. After the interval, it began with them in the same position, and through the curtain Marina could be seen with her back to the audience. I don't think Marina can be a terribly rewarding part. She's very pure and chaste and virtuous and sweet, but not much else. She seems rather too good to be true. She didn't move me at all. Although, judging by the sniffs that were going on during the reunion between her and Pericles, she succeeded with a large part of the audience. The brothel scene didn't seem so funny this time, and there weren't many laughs. It left a rather nasty taste. They brought Marina in with a very repulsive-looking red veil over her head. I don't think I should have felt like marrying a man I met in such a place, even if he was drunk. Marina sang something by her father's couch. I thought that scene was quite affecting last time, but Daddy thought it was contrived, and I'm not sure I don't agree with him. It didn't seem terribly spontaneous or real. After Gower had sung his last lines, the sailors chanted and rowed again, so it ended as it had begun. Pericles had very gorgeous purple and blue robes at the end, and it's nice to think that everyone had a happy ending who deserved it. There was a lot of applause before the red curtain came down and the house lights went on. Today was the 50th time I've been to the Memorial Theatre. Friday, November the 28th. Some rumours of next season were in the paper. Paul Robeson as Othello, Edith Evans in All's Well That Ends Well, which may be in modern dress, and Sam Wanamaker as Iago, but I think that may be wrong because I've heard Laurence Olivier will play that. I'm rather thrilled about Edith Evans, and it's said that Cyril Luckham may play Gloucester in King Lear. We're hoping Glenn Byamshire will produce that. The sets of the three plays for Russia have been packed up, and the Romeo one has already gone. But I must stop thinking about next season. There are still 29 hours left of this one, and I must go and get ready for the last night of Pericles. I feel this has been quite a unique evening, the last performance of this collector's piece, probably for many years. We sat on the end of row G and could see quite well, although we were rather to the side. Before it started, the front-of-house manager came onto the stage, looking rather funny in his evening suit amongst all the exotic scenery. The talking stopped and he made an announcement. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the last performance of Pericles. I can't remember the exact words of his short speech, but he said Mr. Edric Connor had unfortunately lost his voice and there was no sign of it returning, so Mr. Edward Woodward had taken over the part of Gower at 2 hours' notice. 2 hours! He had understudied it, but I expect it was rather a shock, especially for a part with so much singing. He's got quite a good singing voice, and he was remarkably good too. He wasn't made up to look like Edric Connor, but he wasn't a terrible anticlimax to him. I enjoyed his performance very much indeed. There was a terrific lot of applause. The sailors came in front of the curtain, then Gower, and then the curtain went up on the rest, who were all clapping Gower, which I thought was nice. He joined them, and after several curtain calls, Richard Johnson stepped forward and held up his hand for silence. We were all very sorry Edric Connor couldn't play Gower, especially as it's the last night of the show, he said. But I should just like to thank Ted for going on and giving such a marvellous performance. He led him forward and left him to bow by himself with the lights blazing down on him to a thunder of applause in which the rest of the cast joined. I think that was a very nice thing to do, and Edward Woodward deserved it. After that, there was one more curtain call, and then the red curtain fell on the last performance of Pericles, Prince of Tyre. I wonder if I shall ever see it again. I think the orchestra must be improving their playing of the national anthem, because it sounded much better lately. The last night of all tomorrow. Boxing Day, 1958. Paul Robeson was singing on the wireless this morning. Uncle and I went to get some more cider as it was starting. I've never been in a pub before. It was quite a cheery little one, the windmill, with a low roof, streamers and men with mugs of beer. When we came home, Paul Robeson was singing Silent Night. I've never heard such a voice. It was like thick black treacle. I am glad he's coming here next year. I hope he'll give some concerts. Monday, January the 12th, 1959. The season starts on April the 7th with Othello, Paul Robeson as Othello, Mary Ure as Desdemona, Angela Baddeley, Amelia, Sam Wanamaker, Iago, Albert Finney, Cassio. The plays are those that were rumoured. Edith Evans is going to play the Countess of Roussillon and Volumnia. I'm going to put the cutting in here so I needn't bother to write it out. Sunday, February the 1st. I forgot to put down yesterday that Paul Robeson is ill in Moscow and has cancelled his engagement. Whether he would have been good or not, I don't know, but it was a horrid disappointment. Glenn Byamshaw is now looking around for somebody else. And with Harry Andrews in the company, I hope he doesn't look too far. Saturday, February the 14th, St. Valentine's Day. Forgot to say yesterday that Paul Robeson is coming to play Othello after all. He's got better. Wednesday, April the 7th. Here starteth the centenary season. Daddy was going straight there again, so we went down fairly early. There were cars parked nearly all the way down Chapel Lane, and the car park was stuffed with them. We climbed the stairs and went to the cloakroom to tidy up first. We sat in row J, and I think they were exactly the same seats as we had for the last night of the last season. There was a lovely atmosphere, charged with expectancy. Jill and I sat next to each other and shared a pair of field glasses. It was late starting, and I thought the lights were never going out. At last they did, and the national anthem was played first, instead of at the end. I prefer it at the beginning. There was a roll of drums, and the curtains rose on the new season. The stage was dark, but gradually became lighter as Roderigo and Iago appeared. I love this play. I fell in love with Othello in 1956, in spite of his jealousy, and this has not been in the least diminished. As a production, I didn't like it as much as Glenn Byamshaw's, but then he takes some equalling, and I wasn't expecting it to be as good as his. But I've decided I'm not going to compare any productions too much in future, and look forward to each one as if I've never seen it before. All it is, really, is the same play in a new dress. Paul Robeson was absolutely magnificent and surpassed all my expectations. In fact, he wasn't Paul Robeson at all, but Othello right from the start. As soon as he spoke, I knew I was all right. A deep, musical voice of which every syllable could be heard. A commanding presence, and just as I imagined the noble Moor. Thank goodness he did come after all. He lived the part and dominated the play. Ian Holm played the Duke as if he'd got asthma, which seemed rather pointless. I'm not going to write a lot now, much as I would like to, because I shall be considered rude if I sit writing while Jill's here, but I shall have plenty more opportunities, I expect. There was only one interval, and we went to the balcony bar. I remembered it was bell practice night, so we went on the balcony. And in the dark, I heard the bells ringing over the water. Ringing in the new season! It sounded lovely. When Othello arrived at Cyprus, there were thunderous cheers, and I felt like joining in. I hate having to abridge this, but I must, though I feel it's almost a crime. The tragedy of this play is simply terrible, as one watches Othello's love for his wife change to suspicion, and finally to murdering her in her bed. Othello's own death made me feel quite tearful, and I agree most thoroughly with Cassio's words, "for he was great of heart." A light shone on the tragic loading of the bed as the curtain came down. I've never seen so many curtain calls. It was wonderful. The clapping went on, and I think there were at least 12 calls for the whole cast. When Othello came in front of the curtain, cheers and stamps, my hands nearly fell off. The curtains kept on going up, and Othello wasn't quite sure whether to go forward or not, and at one point the curtain came down on his head, and he got muddled up in it. Friday, April the 10th. It's gorgeous to see the yellow flag on the theatre through the trees, from every angle, and realise that Shakespeare reigns in Stratford for 7 glorious months. It was pouring with rain when we were ready to go. Mummy gave us an umbrella, and on the way down Chapel Lane we got it stuck between a lamppost and the hedge. We got our coats rather wet. We sat in row E in the middle. Critics have condemned it, but I don't think it's so bad as they say, and I thoroughly enjoyed myself, especially when hearing the rich musical voice of Othello. When he first came on, he was in a street with Venetian arches above him, and for the court scene red hangings came down, and most of the senators were in red as well. The Duke sat coughing and wheezing, and in the end was carried out. Desdemona made her first appearance in orange. When Othello was really loving her, it seemed impossible that he could ever be brought to mistrust her, and the love scenes were very sweet and tender. Iago wears brown all the time. I still can't make up my mind about him. He's peculiar. With the last one, I loathed him all the time. But this one gave me the feeling sometimes that he was really quite a nice chap, but pretending to be evil. Even when he made a clean breast of his intentions in his soliloquies, I didn't feel disgust, and when he said, "I hate them all," I hardly believed him. Sunday, April the 26th. Shakespeare Sunday. Paul Robeson wasn't in the procession, but I saw him come in through the porch and sit at the front to read one of the lessons, as I had hoped. It was a lovely service. Daddy and Mummy made remarks about heathens who only go to church once a year, that I wouldn't miss this particular service, even though I don't go with the right attitude. But that's because I don't know what my attitude is yet. Paul Robeson stood up to read the first lesson, and "Let us now praise famous men and our fathers that begat us" rolled round the church in his rich, fruity voice. By sitting on the extreme edge of my seat, I could see him, the enormous negro standing at the lectern, making the air vibrate, surely a unique experience. I could see the light falling through the windows in the chancel, and although I couldn't see the monument, I knew it was there, and I could picture it. The first hymn was "Jerusalem," absolutely wonderful and just right. It made me feel prickly all over. Later, the choir sang "Fear No More the Heat of the Sun." The tune was a trifle dreary, but it sounded pleasant. Shakespeare's own hymn. If I went to church regularly, I think I should get a bit tired of the incessant droning of psalms and responses. It doesn't always seem very sincere to me. On the other hand, I much prefer a Church of England service to a nonconformist one. I like the pageantry, and when I get bored with the droning, I look at the beautiful stone arches and the windows, the high roof, the carved pulpit, and the little altar directly in front of us. I suppose I should be ashamed to say. I leaned forward to peek at the grey-haired, pink-faced Glen Byam Shaw. Sunday, September the 6th. A most beautiful evening, the best production of the season by far. As usual, I was ready before I need have been, and danced with impatience in the hall, while Mummy tried to decide which coat she was going to wear, and Daddy finished writing a letter. We got there in the end, just before 8 o'clock. We were in row E, about the middle. It was almost a full house. There was a square of white carpet on the stage, and a table with two chairs each side of it, with dull blue seats. On the table was a bowl of red, white, orange and mauve zinnias, and the harp was over to the right. Just after 8 o'clock they arrived. Peggy Ashcroft in a black evening dress, all gauzy on top. Paul Robeson, not looking quite so big in ordinary clothes, and Ossian Ellis, who appears to be very modest, always trying to keep in the background. There was terrific applause, even before they started, so they had to sit and listen to it before they could begin. It stopped at last. I never realised what could be done on a harp before. It was almost incredible to watch his fingers finding the strings so surely and so rapidly. Then Peggy Ashcroft read Psalm 150, the "Praise Ye the Lord" one. Actually, her voice didn't reach its full power until after the interval, but I didn't mind, and just drank it in and gazed at her through the glasses, until Barbara took them and hogged them. I wish she'd have that bubble cut again. It's much nicer than the one she's got now. I do hope she comes next season. These brief visits just keep me going, but I want her to be here for a nice long season again. After the psalm, Paul Robeson sang Handel's "Art Thou Troubled," which was one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard. He was accompanied on the harp, and his rich voice rolled out, deep and full of feeling. When he'd finished, and the last bars on the harp had died away, through the stillness came Peggy's gentle voice. "If music and sweet poetry agree," a poem by Shakespeare, which I've never come across before. I must try to find it. I've never seen or heard of it before. Paul Robeson's next song was one by Roger Quilter, "Now Sleeps the Crimson Petal." And then Peggy read "Music When Soft Voices Die" by Shelley. This concluded the first section. There were four altogether, two before the interval and two after. There was applause after each one. They read "Dialogue Between the Soul and Body" by Marvell together, and we heard Paul Robeson's speaking voice for a change. He doesn't look nearly as dark as he does in the photographs. His hands looked as if they were deeply suntanned. I began to think of the two as Desdemona and Othello in a happier existence. The play might have been written for them, and I wish I could see Peggy as Desdemona, although I can imagine it. They were obviously warm and friendly and happy together, and they seemed just like the two characters in the flesh, in a sort of heaven together, far from domestic strife and discord. It was like a happy sequel to the tragedy. The last poem before the interval was Thoughts by D.H. Lawrence. I thought it would be soulful, but instead it was very funny. They read it together and kept saying rude things about love, Peggy insulting men and Paul Robeson insulting women, and saying he wasn't going to love or have any more talk about the warmed cockles of his heart. We went to get a breath of fresh air in the interval. As Barbara had been hogging the glasses rather a lot, I said she could have them for the third part, and I was keeping them for the last one, a proposition to which she reluctantly agreed. Although there were only three items in the last part, I had the best bargain, really, because I had them when Paul Robeson sang Negro Spirituals. Peggy read In the Beginning by Dylan Thomas, which was followed by The Creation, a Negro sermon by James Weldon Johnson, which Paul Robeson read, of course. He got quite carried away in it and finished with a fervent Amen, Amen, which was followed by a burst of applause. Paul Robeson read two poems from Songs of Innocence by Blake, Little Lamb Who Made Thee, and one which would have done those white rats in South Africa good to hear. My mother reared me in the southern wild, and I am black, but oh, my soul is white. Miss Williams reads it in prayers sometimes after talking about the colour bar. Then he sang a lullaby by Schubert, one verse in English and one in German. He knows 24 languages and has just learnt Chinese. That was the end of part three, so I seized the field glasses. Then came the spirituals. The first was the one with Let My People Go. He seemed a different man, like a god with thunder in his voice. Go down, Moses, and let my people go, cracked through the theatre, and the harp was almost drowned. The second one was a funny one, about David and his little harp. I had a good look at Peggy during this one and the next one. She was sitting looking at him, with one elbow resting on the table, and I watched a smile gradually spread across her face. In the next one, which was a very serious one, she was staring up into space and looking as if she'd forgotten herself completely, so under the spell. She looked quite moved, and in the end she looked down at her lap. After the spirituals, there was one more poem, And Death Shall Have No Dominion by Dylan Thomas, and that was the end. They stood up and bowed, smiling to the accompaniment of tumultuous applause. And after coming back for about the fourth time, they had to sit down again and give an encore. Paul Robeson sang another spiritual, beginning, If There Are Any Among You. They went off again, and back they came to be greeted with cheers and thumps and a proper uproar. Paul Robeson made the other two go off in front of him, and then followed, clapping them himself. The lights dimmed, and Daddy said, You won't get them again. But once again, the lights went on and they returned to bow once more, holding hands, beaming all round with cheers, stamps and clapping surging up to them. As they went off, Peggy patted Paul Robeson on the arm. Let them go, they're tired, said Mummy. So after that, the audience did, and the stage darkened for the last time, and we reluctantly left. That was the best production. It was perfect, and I could hardly stop smiling all the way home. A recital like that, with people like that, makes even a rotten season like this memorable. Monday, November the 9th, my 17th birthday. Barbara and I went on ahead. I sat in state in a 5 bob, and the others were just behind me in row H. It has improved considerably since April, especially Iago, who doesn't fidget nearly so much. In April, I was so anxious for it to be good that I tried to blind myself to its faults and pretend it was wonderful, but I'm not going to do that anymore. Desdemona was a bit better, but I don't think she's the right type at all. Iago speaks all the verse as if it were prose, which is awful, especially Not Poppy, nor Mandragora, nor all the drowsy syrups of the world, which is too ghastly to be described. I think they ought to have had someone like Albert Finney or Anthony Nichols for Iago, who look really honest, pleasant men, and then the shock would be far more effective when the real character appeared. This one is just evil all the time. But Othello was unchanged, and he's the one that matters. From his very first words, "'Tis better as it is,' the atmosphere changed. His voice made all the others weak and watery, so full of music it sounded in parts as if he was nearly singing. "Put up your bright swords, for the dew will rust them," was like a trumpet, full of compelling authority. What a man! Even if he is a soldier and lives by making war, he's lovable and so warm-hearted and human, not like Coriolanus. I can't believe Othello got pleasure from war as that rat did, and I'm sure he could be merciful. It is a terribly painful tragedy, more so than Hamlet, really, because at least he dies with his task accomplished, and with no sense of remorse. But Desdemona is killed almost before she knows why, and doesn't have time to understand, and then Othello kills himself in awful disillusion and misery. I love, her father loved me, oft invited me, and it was beautiful. In Hamlet's So Oft It Chances With Particular Men, Shakespeare seems to sum up his idea of tragedy, and as you study the plays more closely, you can see how it applies. Othello with his jealousy, Macbeth with his ambition, and so on. They don't use nearly enough light, none at all when Cassio is attacked, and they keep shining a spotlight on Iago like a pantomime. I might see it again because Marion wants to go. Thursday, November the 26th. We are going to Othello tonight. We came home not knowing whether to hope for tickets or not, but we're all right. Faye and Marion are both doing their homework. It's the last night of Othello, and might be the last performance Paul Robeson ever gives as Othello. I'm so glad I'm going to see it again. We all had poached eggs and then went down to the theatre at 6:30. We were first in the queue. I saw this production begin, and now I've seen it finish. I've not seen it close up before, and as I was nearer, and also trying to make the most of the last night, I enjoyed it a bit more. Although it's bad, if I had the chance of seeing one of the season's plays again, this would be the one. Partly because I love the play, but mainly because Othello is Othello all over. He really is, and when he was on stage, everything else just melted away. We were doing the Italian Wars in history, and in the court scene, it all fitted in, with the Doge and his Senate and the news about the Turks. It was like our history syllabus and the pages of Renaissance and Reformation coming to life. The cheers for Othello when he landed at Cyprus have never been so loud as they were at the first night. I got the impression then that they were cheering for the actor and not the person. Othello is an example of someone who lives by war and bloodshed, but is a lovable person as well. He doesn't make me think war is any better, but shows that soldiers aren't always cruel beasts. Iago just got on my nerves this time. He kept laughing in the middle of his speeches, and I should never have thought that blank verse could be destroyed so utterly. You couldn't even beat out the meter or visualise it written as a poem. It was dreadful. But Othello's was perfect. Her father loved me, oft invited me. And then, at the end, in a voice so beautiful it couldn't be described, she loved me for the dangers I had passed, and I loved her, that she did pity me. It was like a strain of music. It is the cause, my soul. Let me not name it to you, you chaste stars. It is the cause. Yet I'll not shed her blood, nor scar that whiter skin of hers than snow, and smooth as monumental alabaster. He never surpassed that. It was the most beautiful moment in the whole play. The murder was horrible. Her death just aches and aches with nothing to soothe it. Poor Desdemona, trying to spare her husband even in her last agony. There was a wonderful ovation for Othello. No, not Othello. He was dead, for the actor who became him completely for 7 months, Paul Robeson. Nearly as tremendous as on the first night. So his great triumph is now over. And even the bad production couldn't dim his brightness. Sunday, November the 29th, the day after the final night of the season. Although it hasn't been a very good season, I can't help but be sorry it's over, for at least Shakespeare could usually be heard. The 100th season could have been so wonderful, and if only it had fallen last year with last year's season, it would have been. I think the trouble has been that all the producers, except one, tried to achieve something absolutely terrific that had never been done before, and all fell grievously short of the mark. They were too clever, and I hope now they realise it doesn't work. Tony Richardson, who was reported to have said, after Othello had been slated, "I'll never see the bloody thing again," can stay away in future, and so can Tyrone Guthrie with his mania for modern dress. Taken by themselves, nearly all the great names have given something great, even if there wasn't much that was great as a whole. And that one extra production, with Peggy Ashcroft, Paul Robeson and Ossian Ellis. Perhaps it wasn't such a flop after all. I don't know why, but these lines are ringing in my head. The best in this kind are but shadows, and the worst, if imagination amend them. Yes, I do. Now I've written them down, I do. What a good epitaph. I can dry up now. Waiting for Robeson is taken from the diary of Chris Penny. The part of Chris was read by Thomas and Bailey, and the director was John Pashley.